From Toronto, Canada, this is 1 MHz, an Apple II podcast. In this episode, an Apple IIc makes front page news when it's bought and unboxed. The first full-time Apple II web server goes live, and there's a new way to give your 2GS a big speed boost. Also, by the pricking of my thumbs, something 16-sector this way comes. All that, plus I take a walk through Crowley Manor, coming up on 1 MHz for February 2008. Welcome to 1 MHz, 8-bit Apple news and 2-bit Apple reviews. And as far as you know, I'm Carrington Vanston. Thanks for listening. So there seems to be something coming to the Apple II world, but I'm not sure what. See if you can figure it out by going to the website 16sector.com. That's spelled 16sector.com. I first heard about it when someone mentioned the site on the comp.sys.apple II news group under the thread titled New Site. The domain name is registered to Tony Diaz, who will be well known to most listeners of this podcast. Now, personally, I know him as the fellow who has way, way, way more spare Apple II nameplates than anybody could reasonably expect to find a use for. The 16sector.com website currently redirects to a page with the file name 2b or 2e.html and the title Ready, Set, Get Serious. Serious as in S-I-R-I-U-S. Oh, lots of spelling in this news item so far, huh? Anyway, the site has a picture of an all-red Apple logo, but flat, like the old style, with the number 16 on it in white, so a 16-sector image. Below that is a composite photo of a paper bag from which is emerging, an expansion card with a pair of cat's legs, sort of like a cat with the head of a daughterboard. And below that is a pink shape, like a square. I guess it's a silhouette of an interface card. It's kind of like one of the rooms from the old Atari 2600 adventure game. So, what's with the cat, huh? Something letting the cat out of the bag is, I guess, the visual pun here. But what do you think it means, my ooey-gooey listeners? On the A2 Central site, Sean Fahey points out that the Ready, Set, Get Serious title might indicate that it has something to do with the 8 meg series card for the 2GS. He also kind of hints that he knows more, but he's unwilling to say. Ooh, secret, secret, secrets. Exciting times in Apple II land, huh? Now, browsing around, as us old-school computer fellows are wont to do, I noted that you can get the directory listing of the 16sector.com/img subdirectory. And in there are a few images of the Apple Cat 2 modem. Mm-hmm. Ah, the Apple Cat. Anybody remember the Apple Cat? Was there ever a cooler modem than that one? If I recall correctly, the Apple Cat was a 300 baud modem, but it could also do the Bell 202 protocol, which means that was a 1200 baud half duplex protocol. So one Apple Cat could talk to another one at 1200 baud. And really, do any of us need more speed than that? I don't think so. Although I would welcome listener email with some calculations on exactly how long this episode of 1 MHz would take to download at 1200 baud. I expect I would shudder at the duration. Anyway, the Apple Cat was it was the ultimate war dialing modem. You know, it could detect just about any call progress tone. So if you wanted to look for interesting numbers, then this was your beast. What else do I remember with the Apple Cat? It could handle BSR, so it could control home appliances. You know, it could power up or shut down household goodies. And it could do it not only during a data session, but also through the touch tone detector, which is crazy cool. Let's see what else. The Apple Cat could control a tape recorder and had a tape-out jack, so it could be used as an answering machine with touch-tone remote message retrieval. And in the context of the time, which is roughly a billion years ago, or a metric billion here in Canada, that was pretty darn impressive. You could use a telephone handset with it. It had a built-in tone generator. You could use it to distort your voice. I mean, nothing could touch this modem in terms of coolness. Certainly the boring lump of beige plastic that I currently have giving me high-speed access here at home has nothing near the features of the AppleCat. Anyway, down a bit of a rat hole there. The news item, 16sector.com. So, this site, what is it? Do you know? Do you want to tell me? Are you named Tony Diaz, and are you mad at me for mentioning the open IMG directory? I wonder if it'll still be open after this episode goes out. We will see. Now, is it an Apple II, or an AppleCat clone, rather? Is it something to do with the 8-meg series card? Is it a USB to disk 2 interface? Oh, one can only dream. My guess, if I had to make one, and I will say that I do have to, my guess is that it's a 16-sector version of the AppleCat software, which I guess would have been 13-sector. It's just a wild guess, though. Heck, maybe it's got something to do with the forthcoming secret projects from Little John Systems. Perhaps that mysterious gumdrop project due at the next Kansas Fest? We'll see. I think it's pretty cool that there are multiple secret Apple II projects in 2008. So keep an eye on the 16sector.com site for, presumably, more details to come. What else? Another interesting site to check out is Luddite's Amazing Apple IIe Web Server. And that's found at port 6502 at www.ld8.org. Now that's LD and the number 8.org. It seems to be the first full-time Apple II-powered web server, but I'm sure someone will write in to correct me if I'm wrong. It's powered by the Contiki 2.0 server software and an Uther card, and yes, indeed, it is hosted on a 1 MHz Apple IIe with 64K of RAM and a single 5.25-inch floppy disk drive. There's not much to see there, aside from a page telling you about the computer itself and a couple of Apple II-related links. I was page view number 1130 when I went to the site earlier today. One interesting item on the site is a link badge for something called the Old Apple Web Server Directory. Now, that site, which looks and navigates like an original pre-Multifinder toaster Mac, has links to sites hosted on so-called obsolete Apples. It was previously called the 68K Macintosh Web Server Directory, but it's branched out to include links to servers on Newton's, Lisa's, and, of course, this solitary Apple II server. The old Mac servers are grouped by processor. So there's the 68K servers, the 68020, and so forth. It goes up to the 68040. So you got everything there from a Mac Plus to a Quadra. There are a few links to servers hosted on LC475s, which reminds me that I really should get around to doing an episode about my own LC475, which has the Apple II compatibility card in it. But I will have a link in this month's show notes to the Luddite's Amazing Apple IIe web server, so you can check it out for yourself. In other website news, everyone's favorite newspaper columnist / bowling teacher, Ken Gagne, has an article on the computerworld.com website entitled Getting Started with the Apple II. Now, probably, if you're listening to this podcast, you've already gotten yourself started with the Apple II, but maybe you want to get even more started-er. If that's the case, then this article should be added to your to-read pile. Ken covers hardware, software, emulators, and where to find news and discussion regarding our favorite 8-bit Wonderbox. I'll have a link in the show notes, because that's the place where links like to spend their leisure time. Ken also has a terrific article on the Computer World site about Dan Budiak's recent purchase of a new-in-the-box Apple IIc on eBay for the cost of... Are you sitting down? Are you sure you're sitting down? Okay, don't say I didn't warn you. He bought the Apple IIc last month for a cost of a little over $2,600. I bet you're sitting down now, huh? Now, the thing is, I totally get that. I listened to the MacBreak Weekly podcast that poked little gentle fun at Mr. Budiak for his purchase, but it doesn't seem outrageous to me at all. I mean, remember, I'm the podcaster who has more than once purchased shrink-wrapped Apple II software only to rip it open on mic and then play it. So who am I to judge? Okay, sure, I haven't dropped a little over 2.5 G's on anything 8-bit, but to me, it's not such a weird purchase. I mean, why am I podcasting, for instance? I mean, really, why am I talking to this microphone right now describing my Apple II hobby? I've got other hobbies, you know. I don't podcast about those. I write. I make independent films. I go geocaching. I recently took up improv comedy and ballroom dancing. I take a weekly culinary course every Wednesday. I listen to old-time radio. I'm taking archery lessons. I'm soon going to sign up for fencing. And I bet I totally lost you at ballroom dancing, didn't I? Okay, well, it's a new one, and I love it, so there. In fact, really, that's the hobby that takes up most of my time. The last couple of months, I have done more of that than anything, and it's pretty much shelved a bunch of my other hobbies in the meantime, which is really the reason I haven't been podcasting 1 MHz for the last while. In case you were wondering, it's because I was too busy dancing. I have a dance partner. We practice a number of times a week. It's totally kicks butt. Okay, how did I get on this topic? Oh, right. The $2,600 Apple IIc. Anyway, my point was that I totally get the motivation behind this kind of purchase. Of all my hobbies, only the Apple II gives me, how'd you put it, both the satisfaction of a present activity and also the warm and fuzzy nostalgia for my misspent youth. I mean, I may review software based on how I think it stacks up today when I'm doing these shows, but that doesn't change the fact that part of the appeal of the Apple II, for me anyway, comes from my association of using it as my youth. This was the computer I grew up with. It wasn't my first computer, but it was the first one I really got to know and love. It was my formative computer, you know? So that brings us to Dan Budiak and his unopened Apple IIc. And what did Dan do when he got his unopened, very expensive computer home? He did the exact same thing that I would have done. He opened it up. Good for him. Now, the general hue and cry on the net seems to indicate that the public at large, the collectors in particular, think that Dan made a foolish move. Now, I disagree completely. It was the right move. In fact, to me, it was the real justification for purchasing the 2C in the first place. I don't collect anything. I mean, nothing at all. No Star Wars figures, no comic books, no decorative plates or ceramic clowns or whatever other people collect. Now, I have a couple of thousand DVDs, but it's not really a collection because I don't have the discs to have them. I have them so that any movie I want to watch, I have it available as soon as I want to watch it. It's not a collection. It's a convenience. The discs themselves are all in envelopes and bags stuffed away in a closet. It's the movies I want, you know, digitized, ripped, and ready to go with the click of a remote. I don't collect Apple II stuff either. I mean, I buy the hardware and software, but I don't hang on to most of it. Heck, I'm going to have another cartoon head cookie jar giveaway soon. I think probably next episode. You know, to give away the items I've been talking about in the last few shows. For me, it's all about reliving the games and programs and gadgets that I loved when I had an Apple II the first time around. And plus also very much about enjoying the modern use of a computer system that I can, well, at least potentially fully understand in a way that I never will my Mac Pro and its successors. I mean, it's not all about nostalgia, but the element is there. And I know full well the thrill of unshrink wrapping some computer thingy that I loved when I was young and getting to re-experience that completely, beginning to end. I mean, it's the feeling that I got when I replayed Task Times at Toontown and especially Portal last year, if you recall that episode. So, I mean, I get it. I get exactly why Dan would unbox the Apple IIc. I would have too, so good for him. And one more thing. An editor's note at the end of Ken's article points out that the article itself was written on an Apple II. Well done, Ken. I'll place some of those newfangled hyperlink thingies that all the kids are talking about in the show notes so you can read Ken's article and also see Dan's amazing unboxing photographs on Flickr. something you would not have thought you would come across in 2008, which seems so far to be the theme of this episode. So, what else is new in Apple II land? Oh, well, just this morning, actually, Henry S. Corbis of Reactive Micro announced an upgrade to the Transwarp GS to bring it to as high as 18.75 megahertz. Now, you'll need to ensure that you got some serious cooling so you don't melt your little 16-bit PAL, but this is a pretty sweet speed boost. Supposedly, not all Transwarp GSs can make it all the way up to 18.75 MHz, but the upgrade seems to offer at least a boost to 18 MHz, which is still a rocket compared to stock GS. Reactive Micro already has a similar upgrade available for the Zip GS, so whichever accelerator you prefer, you can now get your speed on. I looked around the Reactive Micro site, but I couldn't find either accelerator's upgrades listed. And I think it's an upgrade service rather than a kit, but I'm not sure. And also, since I couldn't find it yet, I don't know what the price is, but it's because it's such a recent announcement. I'll put a link to the Reactive Micro site in the show notes, and I'm sure there will be something there for you to see by the time you hear this. And I guess... Yeah, I think that's enough news for now. Let's get to the episode's review. Just one review this month, and unsurprisingly, it's another game. I do tend to review only games, huh? I don't mean it to be that way. I've been wanting to do a word processor shootout for ages now. But frankly, I really don't have much nice to say about any Apple II word processor that I've used. I mean, nothing nice, that is, if I review them with an eye toward comparing them to what else is available on so-called modern computers nowadays. And I don't want to do a review based strictly on nostalgia. I want to make recommendations based on using something right now in 2008. When I review games, I review them based on the experience I'm having now, not the imagined experience I would have if this was the mid-80s. So no word processors this month. Instead, once again, I will bring you a game review. And this time it's The Curse of Crowley Manor. Now, it's a graphical adventure game, and like most Apple II graphical adventure games, the graphics don't add much. In fact, with this one, it's, as is often the case, I think, the graphics actually take something away from it. Now, instead of richly evocative descriptions that let you build up a detailed image in your mind, you get blocky, low resolution by today's standards, pixelated, poorly drawn doodles that, well, they not only poorly lay out the scene, they sometimes mislead you by displaying items you can't interact with, and once, near the end of the game, they misled me hugely by not displaying something that I could interact with. Oh, very frustrating. The puzzles are not baffling, and some of them are not even really puzzles, but just sort of strange implementations, is I guess the way you'd put it. For instance, you start off inside a locked room, presumably your office. If you try the door, you're told, you can't open it. Aha, thinks you, a puzzle. I have to find some sort of key, or a deadbolt I can turn, or I have to kick the door open. Nope, what you have to do is wait. See, the door is held fast by the most insidious of locks, programmer's convenience. The trick to opening the door is to, and I'm going to give you a little spoiler because this is the very beginning of the game. The trick to opening the door is wait until the telephone rings. And once you've taken a call, then suddenly the door is now functional. The problem here, of course, is poor writing. Unfortunately, it's just the kind of sloppy writing you usually find in graphical adventure games. When you try the door early on in the game, instead of being told something like, you can't open it, why not say something like, you shouldn't leave yet, maybe a client will call, or you just got to work. If you leave so soon without a case, you might get fired. You know, in a pinch, they could have just gone with, you can't open it, ... yet. Anything else. There are other logical problems throughout the game. For instance, shortly after solving the non-puzzle of the door, you encounter a hansom cab and its somewhat less handsome driver. If you look at the driver, you're told simply, it appears ordinary. That's the I have nothing to say default phrase in the game, regardless of whether you examine an item, a person, a collection of things, whatever. When Crowley Manor has nothing to say, you get, it appears ordinary. So, anyway, If you examine the driver after engaging the services, now you're told you can see a vial of holy water. Now, long-time players of adventure games might know enough to re-look at a character when you move, because to the game, you're in a different quote-unquote room, and inventory items might be attached to the room rather than the character, but, you know, woe unto the newbie. The vial, actually, the vial's a good thing to bring up, because it brings me to another shortfall of the game, and that is the parser. Now, it's okay, but it's not terrific. It's certainly nowhere near up to Infocom standards. This vial, for instance, you can't take it. You can, however, get it. There are a bunch of instances in the Curse of Crowley Manor where I had to play the synonym game with both verbs and objects before I could accomplish some obvious task. Like with the cab, you can't get in it, and you can't take the cab. You must climb in the cab. Okay, fair enough. But you can't climb out. You have to get out. If you try to climb out, you're told you'll fall. Inconsistency of verbs is not the hallmark of a good parser. Another example of how the parser sort of gets in the way of the game is at one point you find a desk. Now you can see the desk in the crudely drawn images, and you can see that the desk is mentioned in the description. And an item is on the desk. I'm trying to be vague here, so I'm not giving any more spoilers. And so the item's easy to get because it's drawn and it's listed in the description. But, you know, just in case, what if you want to rifle through the desk as well? I mean, it's a desk. You can't look in the desk. You can't look under the desk. You can't examine the desk. You can't search the desk. You can't open the drawers. The magic phrase is just open desk and nothing else will do. I had some trouble with directions in the game too. Like a lot of early graphic adventures, the location images aren't always drawn oriented the same way, which is kind of confusing because sometimes you're facing south, sometimes you're facing east, and so forth. So no static, and there's no static text line which tells you the direction of the exits like it does on like the Scott Adams adventures, for instance. So sometimes it takes a bit of guessing just to get the game to walk you down the corridor that you're facing. The inventory system is well implemented and it's easy enough to use. You can get things and drop them, provided you know which verb to use with which item. And items stay where you've dropped them in case you want to retrieve them later, so that's good. Now, you can only carry 6 items at a time, which is one of those limits that I always find a little bothersome in these games. It didn't really get in the way of this game, though, because it's usually apparent where and how you'll use an inventory item, and you can drop things when they're unneeded or once they're used. Some of the items need to be referred to as their full descriptions, including adjectives, but others don't. And so that was sort of annoying. For instance, there's an ID card, and you can call it either ID card or just card. But if you find the gold key, you have to call it the gold key. You can't just call it key. And strangely, sometimes I would receive this harsh "not now" with an exclamation point when trying something that previously gave a different response. One's an example. So I encountered a crank, not a conspiracy theorist, an actual hand crank. And looking at it revealed why the crank was stuck. If you looked at it again, though, anytime later in the game, you just got this harsh "not now." I have no idea where that was coming from. It was really strange. The save game mechanism permits just a single save, which is stored on the game disk itself. So you type save game to write the game state to a file, and then load game to restore it. Simple enough. But it doesn't permit multiple saves. So in case you want to explore down different game paths and test things, you can use the save games like fingers stuck in a choose your own adventure book. This one only gives you the one save, so there's nothing, no exploring like that going to happen without gambling. Though it does restore so quickly that it's the one game really was enough, I found, as a save. Though it does mean that if you buy a used copy of this game, as I did, then, as I did, you will be able to load up the previous owner's save from his last save position in case you just want to skip to the end. So it was sort of a neat experience. Very first thing I did in the game was type load game. And then go back to the beginning, obviously. So anyway, the save thing, though, sort of the jumping to the end brings me to the, I guess what is, I'll make the last in this long list of problems I had with the game. It's the ending, which is fine, you know, as plots go, you do face down the big baddie at last, but there's no final image when you win. Like, not even another of the crew doodles, just this flash and then a line of text saying congratulations from the game's authors. And there's this timing thing you have to do at the end where you're given a bunch of opportunities to do something and you have to do it at the exact right of those opportunities. Bit annoying, but the clues are there. So it is a fair puzzle. But the end itself, though, that just that little flash and then a congratulations text, I found that really unsatisfying. Really? You know, I found the whole game unsatisfying. Okay, let's sum it up. The drawings are crude and sometimes inaccurate, which is worse. The puzzles are rudimentary. The text has a bunch of spelling mistakes. The parser is way too limited. And you have to play the synonym game all the time. And the ending's disappointing. So, do I recommend The Curse of Crowley Manor? Unsurprisingly, I'm going to go with no. Now, I love me some adventure game goodness, but I don't know. This was just too lacking in any of the qualities that make an adventure game fun to play. I mean, really, I can't think of a single element of this game which measures up to its contemporary peers, let alone to modern adventure games. It doesn't take long to play, so that's good. I did it all in one setting in a relatively short time in the afternoon. So it's not a big investment, but you could probably pick another game, and I would recommend just doing a different adventure game or something. If you're a completionist and you simply need to play all of the Apple II games that you can get your hands on, well, then your name is probably Carrington and this is your podcast. But for everyone else, I recommend playing a text-only adventure, like one of the Infocom games, or one of the better graphical adventure games, like Task Times and Toontown. So that's my opinion. I will post screenshots, because I took them, and a link to the disc image, so you can check out the game yourself, if you'd like to. I made a map of the game as I went, so I will post that as well, because there didn't seem to be a map on the internet, so I'll contribute that. If you do play it, then let me know what you think. I always welcome email telling me how very, very wrong I am about a piece of software. Won't be the first time, won't be the last time, and I won't take it personally. So, fire away. And I think that about wraps it up for this episode. Just wanted to knock out a quick game review and bring things up to date on the news and sort of let you guys know that I missed you and hoped you missed me. And sorry for the delay, but like I said, I had dancing to do. Now, I know I left a whole bunch of threads hanging in the last section or the last series of One Megahertz shows. I've got other reviews that are half recorded. I've got a Kansas Fest wrap up to give you. I mean, I got to do that. Oh, you know, in the meantime, I should tell you that on the 1 Megahertz site, which is at monsterfeet.com, I did post my photos from my trip down to Kansas Fest. So you could look at those in the meantime. And then in the next episode, I will tell you about the trip, which exceeded my expectations in every way. The people that I met, the things that we did, it was everything I could possibly hope it could be. It was a phenomenal trip. I just loved it. So I will tell you all about that next month. I do intend to return back to the monthly schedule. So this will be the February episode and I'll knock out a March one at the end of this month or first week of April, that sort of thing. Probably, maybe, no promises. If you've been sending feedback, and I have over the last few months received a lot of email, so thanks so much for the feedback. I really do love to get it. I've heard comments from a few people that they hadn't heard back from me on things, so I think my spam filters were far too aggressive. I've toned them down a bit for the feedback address. So if you wrote in before and you didn't get a reply, you can pretty much count on the fact that I didn't get your email. So maybe you want to resend it. Because I do try to reply to everything that I get, and I do appreciate your feedback, and I appreciate the fact that you listen to my show. I know you got a lot of podcasts to choose from, and the fact that you actually spend some time listening to me babble on my 8-bit hobby, boggles my mind, but also I do appreciate it. And I love to hear about your 8-bit hobbies. So if you've got Apple II tales to tell or feedback of the reviews or anything like that, I do really love to get your letters. So thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you soon. You've been listening to 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast. Feedback and suggestions can be sent by email to feedback@monsterfeet.com. All the files and links mentioned in this episode can be found in the show notes in the 1 Megahertz section of the monsterfeet.com website. And like all Monsterfeet podcasts, all the original material in this episode is released to the public domain.